The Natural Resources Finance Division will come to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Lee, have you reviewed the minutes?
Mr. Chair.
I have reviewed the minutes, Mr. Chair, and I move adoptions of the minute for March 5th.
Representative Lee moves the minutes from March 5th. Any discussion? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. A lot of ayes there, Representative Lee. Minutes are adopted. Our first item on the agenda this afternoon is a presentation on plastics. And members, you have in your packet, you have a booklet on plastic and health. And in addition, as we're getting ready for this, I just want to note we did have a meeting scheduled for Friday. That has been canceled. So we will not have a meeting on Friday. The bills today, the Clean Water Fund, we will be hearing the bill, and then we will be laying that over to be considered next week, I believe next week or later. Still haven't figured out the day yet on that. So later, I hear. So first we will have this presentation on plastics by Lisa Ann Hamilton from the Center of International Environmental Law. Ms. Hamilton, welcome.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. Can everybody hear me okay? Is there anything I need to do to adjust the sound? No?
Maybe if you move the microphone up just a little.
That's better?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. Does that work? Okay, fantastic. Well, first of all, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you so much for having me here today. My name is Lisa Ann Hamilton. I am the director of the Climate and Energy Program for the Center for International Environmental Law. I am based in Washington, D.C., and work with colleagues as well in our Geneva office. Much of my presentation today will be to give an overview of the plastics pollution crisis and to highlight key findings from the report from my colleagues on plastics and health. I believe at the table behind me, there is not only the report itself, but a short four-pager that provides a good introduction to the executive summary and some of the key findings. So just a little bit about CL. Since 1989, we have used the power of law to protect the environment, promote human rights, and ensure a just and sustainable society. My goal here today is to provide a diagnostic, an overview of our plastics pollution crisis, not only to provide some context about how we've gotten to this point, but also to highlight the impacts on human health, on the environment, and some of the solutions that have been showing early signs of effectiveness in reducing the amount of plastics in the waste stream. So I just want to start off about where we are with the plastics pollution crisis. By some estimates today, we are about approximately 8 million metric tons of plastic that goes into the ocean every year. By some accounts, there is, and some of this research is emerging as we speak, but that at the current rate that we're going, that there's an anticipation that there could be more plastics than fish in the oceans by 2050. And so what that means is, how did we get to a point of so many millions of tons of plastics that are not being properly managed, that are not in some form of organized landfill recycling facility? Much of it is leaching through our rivers, ocean waterways, and ending up in the environment. Plastics are, there is no such thing as a way with plastics by virtue of all of the characteristics that make it flexible, rigid, enduring is also what makes it such a detrimental impact on our environment. I want to show this particular slide. This is from the EPA demonstrating the rate of plastics production versus the rate of plastics recycling. The red line is the plastics production since 1960, which is a fairly steep incline. And as you can see, that limited little blue line is the rate of plastics that have been recycled. And that represents less than 9% of all plastics ever produced have been recycled, which means they end up in the environment. And this, what this highlights also is that for many ways, plastics recycling is something that is often part of the use, reuse, and recycle. And without taking a serious look at the rates at which we do recycle, we're not fully answering the question of how we are addressing the plastics crisis. So one of the main takeaways of some of the research that CL has done over the last several years is that the scale and size of this crisis is really too big to solely focus on any one point. It requires a life cycle approach. That means beginning with the start of plastics, how fossil fuels, nearly 90% of all plastics come from fossil fuels, at the point of extraction, through transportation, refining, manufacturing, and then waste management or mismanagement, you're looking at a life cycle of fossil fuels. And with those fossil fuels come a host of toxics and additives that have a detrimental impact on human health. And so while we're looking at a crisis where millions of metric tons a year are going into our oceans and waterways, we risk food security when we can estimate that almost we will be looking at oceans that are nearly as full of plastics as fish, we're moving in the wrong direction in many ways when we look at the production of plastics. In particular, in September of 2018, the American Chemistry Council estimated that there are approximately 333 petrochemical projects, plastics production falls under that umbrella, and $202 billion in new investment projected for the expansion of plastics infrastructure. And this includes everything from ethane crackers to pipelines to compressor stations, fractionators, expansion of terminals that all will contribute to expanding the plastics pipeline. And here again, when we are starting to receive compelling findings from research that says there are numerous detrimental impacts to human health, it is particularly disturbing that we're facing almost a 36 to 40% increase in plastics production on top of what we're already seeking to manage. So one thing I want to highlight is the work that CL is doing today. We have just released the first of two reports on the life cycle of plastics. The first, the one that's here in front of you today, is our Plastics and Health Report. This report highlights the hidden costs of plastics and a plastic planet, and that's the report that I'll be spending most of my time addressing today. And again, we're taking a life cycle approach, starting from the point of extraction through all the way to the end of waste management, and I'll share some of the findings that we highlight in that report. So again, if we start at the very beginning, 90% of all plastics are fossil fuels. By virtue of the fact that the U.S. is experiencing an unprecedented boom in shale extraction, these make for cheap and effective feedstocks for plastics. And so in many ways, from the point of those wellheads, many of them throughout the Marcellus, Utica shales in Pennsylvania, we're seeing increased expansion in the Permian Basin in Texas, for the areas where hydraulic fracturing is becoming the primary way of extracting feedstocks, we have a whole host of toxic health impacts. Many of those wellheads contain thousands of chemicals that have been known to create a number of human health impacts, everything from toxicity, particularly increases the level of toxicity in the liver, low birth weight, detrimental fetal impacts, problems with, when we look at the full range of health impacts. We are particularly concerned about the location of those wellheads, where they are, reference to schools, the release of methane at each stage of production, as well as the chemical impacts related to wastewater management. As I mentioned before, the billions of dollars of new investment will be attributed to ethane crackers. So those are the facilities themselves that produce the plastics. Again, we're looking at both direct and indirect emissions when it comes to CO2 impacts from greenhouse gases. We're looking at the series of chemicals, benzene, toluene, among others that lead to, again, numerous toxic impacts infecting air, water, and soil contamination. And we're also looking at the number of pollutions, particularly persistent exposure for workers of those facilities. Recent studies have been done on the concerns with plastics in oceans and waterways. Again, because there is no away in plastics, what we're seeing is that plastics degrade into nano and micro particles. Those particles become part of the waterway and waste stream. This next slide is also a part of the CL report on the hidden impacts of plastics, and again, really takes apart what these hidden costs are, the impacts on the central nervous system, the lungs, liver, kidneys. Much of this science, again, is still emerging, but early findings are disturbing. And again, where we are in a situation where we risk 36% to 40% increase in plastics, these findings are worth studying further. Lastly, I want to highlight this issue of the multiple pathways for human exposure to microplastics through seafood. Again, when these plastics that are not appropriately managed are leached into our waterways, they end up in our seafood, particularly these microplastics that become so tiny they evade collection and are not able to be captured by many of the ocean cleanup efforts that are currently underway. We're seeing increased amounts of those toxins and additives that are produced in the plastics production process, in not only shellfish, but in fatty tissue fish as well. Although I didn't go into very much detail about this portion, for those who are particularly interested on what we can do about the climate crisis and how we contribute to it, the production of plastics releases extreme amounts of greenhouse gas emissions at each stage of that very same life cycle. When we talk about the need to accelerate our commitments to reach the ambitions of keeping global temperatures to 2 degrees and, more importantly, to 1.5 degrees to avoid the worst impacts, plastics in many ways is a low-hanging fruit to that. We recognize the concern about the sheer volume and scale of the problem and the amount that's being produced. Commitments to address the extent to which this expansion is occurring is particularly helpful in addressing this particular crisis as well. And here again, this slide just sort of captures that we are on a runaway path for plastic production alone to exceed the carbon budgets in a number of OECD countries. This one was those statistics were for the EU. One thing that has been working particularly well that I want to highlight as far as solutions are the plastic bag bans and plastic bag fees. In certain instances where plastic bag fees have often replaced plastic bag bans, you've not only increased the amount of revenue for the particular municipality, you have increased the amount of revenue for the particular retailer, but you have often removed as high as 80% of plastic bags from the waste stream. That means less plastic waste becoming part of the infrastructure maintenance, less waste contamination of rivers, creeks, and other waterways. So again, I do want to reiterate for those who are, in fact, committed to plastic, we do encourage a broader and more comprehensive approach to understanding plastics as part of the greenhouse gas emissions cycle and ways in which we can further monitor our emissions by monitoring the production of plastics. I want to highlight that CL is part of a global effort of more than 800 organizations that are part of the Break Free from Plastics Coalition. These individual groups all share this same commitment to ensure food security, to ensure environmental integrity, to ensure we do not suffer the detriments of endocrine disruption, among other toxic impacts as a result of plastics, and are ready to support efforts from everything to cleanups to zero-waste cities to approved efforts to recycle, as well as plastic ban straw bans and fees. I also want to highlight that CL has been a part of the effort to ensure that good quality information on the plastics crisis is ready and accessible, and I do want to highlight the four briefing notes that we've issued over the last 18 months called Fueling Plastics. It's a four-part series that also provides additional information. So I will stop there. Thank you so much for your attention, and I appreciate you having me here today.
Any questions? Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I was struck by the comment about how much energy it takes to build plastic or build plastic products. In Ag Committee, we heard about some of the new biodegradable polymers that are being developed. Do they take the same amount of energy to make these plastic cups, plastic plates that are biodegradable plastics?
So I really want to dissect this question of biodegradable plastics very carefully. The caution here is to beware of some of the greenwashing that is happening with biodegradable plastics. For too many of them, they still make up some fossil fuels are still very much a part of their components, as well as the fact that a number of the additives that may be part of their production, whether it's to add color, structure, firmness, often makes it not quite the green solution, the most optimal solution that we would like to have. So I do want to caution that before we get to the discussions of energy and energy comparison, which I confess I have not done that comparison on the product themselves, primarily because I continue to be wary about biodegradables as an option. Another point is that we continue to have this issue about separating out plastics so they can be truly recyclable and reusable. And as long as we have these sort of mixed sort of hybrid chemicals that also make that process of separating and truly using and reusing challenging. So I do not want to say that there is no future pathway for biodegradables, but at this point in time, it's important to be discerning.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. And then the other question I have is, my understanding, and this is hearsay, but our warehouses are filling up with plastic because of, from trade disputes to other things, that we are not selling as much of our used plastic on the market. Is there any trends for getting this plastic that we're accumulating reused?
Ms. Hamilton.
Two things I want to speak to that. The first is, we in the United States that have been huge consumers of plastics had managed to negotiate our way of the full impact of the there is no such thing as a way with plastics, and so we were selling our plastics overseas, and a number of the countries said no more. We've had enough. We're not going to buy this from you anymore. So what this highlights, again, is there will be increased pressure on waste management facilities in the U.S. that had been able to take advantage of these overseas markets that are now closed to us. So I am not only skeptical about the likelihood of reviving those, because those countries are also mindful of their own efforts to manage that waste, but I also think that it is an important point for all of us to rethink how we use our plastics. It is a lesson in how do we reduce our consumption, how do we ensure that there are viable alternatives in ways that are smarter and better, and not so much about how do we pass this along to other countries.
Thank you. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hamilton, just curious, do you know, are there any studies right now regarding microplastic in some of our local bodies of water? You know, my district is right next to the Mississippi, and we also, you know, have Lake Superior and, you know, different bodies of water here throughout the state. Do you know, are there any studies being done about microplastic in Minnesota or around the country?
Thank you, Chairman. To the best of my knowledge, these studies are still very much emerging. I will say that my colleagues with Five Gyres have done a good number of studies about the impact of plastics and waterways in California. And so there is growing concern that, number one, many of the studies that have been done, or the studies that have been done, they're looking at what are we seeing in our waterways before we can get to a full understanding of the full environmental and health impacts. I think, again, the concern is that, as, again, plastic degrades, it does not go away. It simply becomes smaller and smaller. Those microplastics emit greenhouse gases. Early studies have shown that as recently as this year. That was a study that was done in connection with the University of Hawaii, looking at there could be greenhouse gas emissions to our ocean plastics. There have been initial studies looking at the way that as plastics degrade, they are those toxins, the chemicals that I listed earlier, are entering into the waterways and become part of the chemical makeup of wildlife. So, again, it's the fish that I believe are most vulnerable to the accumulation of plastics in many ways. And whether you have river keepers or your fishermen and women as recreational who want to eat that fish, the increased vulnerabilities to endocrine disruption, increased likelihood of cancers, including leukemia, there are signs of those chemicals linked to those conditions. There is still a lot of research that needs to be done to understand the extent to which the accumulation of those chemicals by virtue of plastics is contributing to those illnesses in our environment.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hamilton, I'm most familiar with the issue of microplastics when it comes to personal care products, beauty products, you know, things that we put on and into our bodies, and especially as a parent, that's where I'm most familiar with the idea of microbeads. I'm wondering if you or your organization have any recommendations. Are there any resources where you can go, you know, as we're each making our personal decisions about our purchases, are there good resources out there so we can look up which products are better than others when it comes to microbeads and microplastics?
Ms. Hamilton.
I think you'll see some good resources in the documents that have been provided today for number one. I do think that there are a number of studies that have been done where they look at alternatives. Again, referring to my colleagues at Five Gyres, they have done something called the BAN list, the ban list, which I believe has been lists a number of alternatives to current uses for plastics. And this is across the board, primarily focused on things like single-use products, packaging, and so forth. So I think that, and I also know that there is some early research, wonderful research. Again, I think the list of resources that is mentioned in the document should provide much of that. But again, I think that there are opportunities where Mothers Out Front, which has been a particularly tremendous advocacy group, who are really mindful of the needs of mothers. I will double check, but I believe they're working on something like this as well.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you for that, because I think a lot of times with consumers, like getting people to make the different choices is part of that is making it easy. You know, so like when, you know, you're in the line with the, you know, in the aisle with the 50 kinds of toothpaste and trying to figure out which one has microbeads and which one doesn't, that's something that's easy for folks to do. So I'll look further into that, and thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A number of our communities, in fact, our biggest cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul and some of their suburbs, get their drinking water from the Mississippi River. And I hear what you're saying about the implication for the Mississippi and what's changing from the plastics. But I'm wondering if there are studies that say what happens once those plastics go through the systems that are right now designed to clean up the water. Is there a reaction with the chlorine that is disinfects our water? Do the beads get through our water? Are there studies that can help us out?
Ms. Hamilton.
I think that you're hitting upon an important issue, which is much of the science is still emerging to understand the full range of impacts. And there's much more science that's needed and much more research that's needed to fully highlight what the full extent of the impacts are. I think that because plastics is so pervasive and because we have full life cycle impacts, and when you have full life cycle impacts, you have cumulative exposure. And so when you discuss, as you just have, we're not even talking about simply the plastics as they degrade in the environment. We're talking about their interaction with other chemicals in the environment. And so, again, Mike, the report that we've just released highlights sources of concern as well as places for future research and investigation. I think we still have a number of challenges as far as transparency, how to come across the information. Many of the participants in the industry are reluctant to fully disclose the full range of chemicals used in many processes, the full range of chemicals, often listing them as proprietary, but to the detriment of human health. So to the best of my knowledge, the report covers what we know of the science, but I know that there is many opportunities to do much more extensive research and study to get to those questions.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hamilton, it strikes me that this is a problem that's bigger than relying on individuals making choices, much like climate change. I'm wondering if you have specific policy proposals for addressing this plastics crisis.
Ms. Hamilton.
Thank you. I think that, number one, I absolutely agree with you that the sheer size and scale of this issue far exceeds only an individual choice-based approach. I do believe, though, that when you do have individuals who take a stand and make a statement, that collectively you send a market signal that does, in fact, impact and change the dialogue. And so it's truly the essence of grassroots advocacy to begin with individual choice. That being said, though, I think that individuals can play a tremendous role in contacting their representatives and saying, I really need you to take this seriously. I need you to make this a priority for me, for my children, for our understanding our human health vulnerabilities and the impact on the environment. Again, I think that there are ways in which we can work collectively that can be win-win when you include families and human health and physicians who know very much about how severe some of these health impacts are, and you couple them with retailers and ensure that these challenges address and meet their needs. And you also work with waste management experts who can really address how do we address this and confront this to ensure that a comprehensive approach is commensurate with the scale of the problem.
Thank Representative you. Morrison.
Thank you.
Any other questions? have a couple questions, kind of following up on the things that we can do. So later in the program today, the committee will be hearing a couple of bills. And Minnesota has passed a legacy amendment about 10 years ago where we look at protecting water quality, water resources. It sounded like much of the discussion you had was on ocean waters or surface waters. I'm wondering about drinking water and groundwater, what we're seeing with report or analysis of, are we finding microplastics, not the microbeads, but just the breakdown products of plastic in groundwater or drinking water?
Again, I want to sort of take the full geography of the life cycle approach in mind here as I answer that question. And again, I preface this with many of these studies are new and emerging and still are showing troubling signs of the extent of those impacts, but more science is needed. When we took our life cycles approach to this, we started with extraction, and we started about looking at the ways in which wastewater chemicals are a part of that extraction process and the ways in which all of these chemicals, again, accumulate over time into the water and the environment. When you talk about microplastics and the detrimental impacts in water, in drinking water, the concern is that we see the accumulation in oceans and creeks. We understand that they degrade, so that you have plastic bottles that become nanoparticles and microplastics. We're seeing that many of those waterways, creeks, are sort of run through down through major waterways and tributaries. And so again, we see the footprint of cumulative exposure and cumulative impact. We understand that the chemicals that are used in those microplastics and plastics are proven to contribute to signs of neurotoxicity, liver and kidney toxicity, central nervous system degradation. We understand that those chemicals in other studies have shown signs to contribute to human health in those ways, and that we know that those chemicals are in microplastics. It still remains, and it's almost a blind risk, because we know that the risk is there. We just don't understand the full extent of it. So again, our report was intended to highlight, yes, this is, as long as there are plastics in our waterways, it will impact our drinking water. As long as you're seeing plastics leaching into our soil, you're going to see cumulative impacts impacting plants and wildlife. It is part of the human food chain, and again, understanding the full extent to which it is a harm is worthy of study.
And to follow up, we've had in previous committee meetings discussion about composting and concerns relating to plastics or leachate from plastics getting into compost, and then also land application of sewage sludge that may have plastics. Do you have any, has there been any research on that, or what are you finding on those particular topics?
I have not specifically seen research on compostable plastics and the extent to which they're leaching specifically. Again, I think it's part of that broader concern about, as long as you have chemicals that have been proven to be toxic in the food, in the waste stream that impacts air, water, soil, without fully understanding the extent to which it is harmful, you're sort of dealing with a loaded gun. We just don't know yet, particularly, again, because we're talking about cumulative impacts. For example, you could have had a morning where you woke up this morning, you put water from your tap into your coffee, you may have fish for lunch, you may be wearing clothes that have plastic fibers, additives in it that goes through your washing machine, that wastewater is now part of the wastewater stream. You may have used a couple of plastic bottles that become part of, into your way. We use plastics in so many different ways, and we are exposed to the chemicals in those plastics in so many different ways. And again, those plastics interact with other chemicals as they make their way through our wastewater stream. And so we know that these are the indications of risk. Again, I think compostable materials is a step in the right direction in many ways for waste management. But again, until we fully understand what the toxic impacts are, more research and study is needed to understand the extent to which it does impact food integrity.
Maybe if I could clarify. So I think the issue we've heard is that when we're composting, there may be plastic that gets put in with the organic waste. And so as it breaks down, then you are getting the plastic into the compost.
Mm-hmm.
Or that, for example, for lunch I had Representative Lee brought me a Hmong sausage that had mm-hmm. a film wrap over it on styrofoam. And what happens with that, the chemicals that are in that, if the food waste is composted, that there may be plastic that gets into the compost, if I'm being clear.
Thank you for clarifying that. And it's a very good question about how do we keep the integrity of compostable foods separate and apart from what we know are the toxic impacts that can be found in plastic packaging. Plastic packaging contains the same chemicals that are derived from fossil fuels. When we know human exposure to plastics, whether it's ingestion, inhalation, or contact with skin, are all ways in which we are exposed to those chemicals. So again, to the best of my knowledge, I am not currently aware of any studies. That doesn't mean there aren't any that exist, but again, I think it's a point of concern to fully understand what the toxic impacts are and the extent to which we're being exposed, that there's still greater opportunity for more research and more study on the issue.
Members, are there any other questions? I had one final question. I had seen some research about as a state, we have a lot of institutional use of plastic, and cities have institutional use of plastic, but we also have washing machines, dishwashers, a variety of things. Is there a way where we can put more filters on, like, washing machine outflow to reduce the microplastics? Are there some simple things that could be done to help cut maybe or reduce that, or is there any research there?
I have to confess that I'm less familiar with these initiatives. I am aware, though, that it is an example by industry. I believe it was determined to be too expensive to add those filters onto washing machines. That would make a tremendous difference in reducing the amount of filters and fibers and additives that are also part of that plastic family. My hope is that just in the way we've handled a number of other toxic releases into the environment, that industry will come on board and will participate in our efforts to reduce plastics in our environment, and hopefully one day those filters will simply become standard as a part of these products.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. And you are going to stay through the whole
committee? Yes, I'm very, very interested in hearing from the committee. So, yes, if you'll have me.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Wagenius. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. While we're getting the slides ready, I would just like to move House File 1251, that it be referred to Committee on Ways and Means.
With a recommended re-referral to the Energy and Climate and Finance Policy Division.
Thank you. Yes.
Representative Wagenius, please present your bill.
Thank you. I am so very pleased to bring to you Dr. Peter Schneider, from the University of Minnesota, an atmospheric scientist, and he is going to give you the background for my bill, but more, just as importantly, I guess I would say, we can see the capabilities of the University of Minnesota to help us as we are working on climate change adaptation. So basically, what the bill before you does is fund the study he is going to be talking about. And with that, I would like to turn it over and welcome Dr. Schneider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you today about this project.
If you could state your name for the record.
Peter Schneider. I'm a associate professor in the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate at the University of Minnesota. As Representative Wagenius said, I am a climate scientist. More specifically, I'm what would be called a climate dynamicist, and I focus a lot on numerical processes, which is relevant to the project that I'm talking about today. I think it's fairly well acknowledged now, fortunately, after many decades of debating the issues of climate change, that it is ongoing. Definitely in this state, and there are a lot of sectors of our state that are being affected by it in to one degree or another. These nine up here are just some of the ones that we have looked at, that I've looked at specifically over the last decade, and worked with people. So this project definitely moves beyond the issue of whether climate change is happening or not, and saying, well, we've got climate change happening, and we now need to acknowledge about how to make our society more resilient and our environment more resilient. Why this project is necessary is because over the last decade, I have worked with many fine people at state agencies, such as those listed below, as well as people in industry and even citizens around the state. And my good colleague, Dr. Mark Seeley, has also spent his entire career going around the state talking to people about this issue. We really need to start talking about making informed adaptation decisions. We've got to start doing that. The time is now. So the approach that I have from this project is to take good information that we have about climate models. Climate models were designed to be global climate models, not to look at local scale impacts. So we have a technique called dynamical downscaling, where we can take a global climate model, such as the one you see there that's situated over Minnesota. It's made up of maybe 20 grid cells. It's very coarse resolution. There's not a lot of detail in that. We can take and run a dynamically downscaled model to produce detail that exceeds what we can see from the original climate model. So if you focus on that box there and look at the Twin Cities there, that's what it then looks like as we do this process. You can see the urban heat island of the Twin Cities. You can see a lot of the detail of the surrounding area as a result of that. Another example is moving forward. This is what it looks like for precipitation in the state of Minnesota for this particular time period. We can run these dynamical models and then look at what the precipitation looks like, say, up in the northern part of the state, and then we can zoom in on that, and we see far more detail. And this is what this gets us. It gets us detail beyond what we can get from our traditional tools to study climate change. So the activities I have in the project are to produce these dynamically downscaled climate model projections for the state of Minnesota on a 3-mile by 3-mile resolution, so far exceeding what we've normally been able to do to date. We've also been able to do it for about 130 years, moving forward to the end of this century, and then with multiple global climate models as our inputs. We would deploy a web portal to disseminate the model results. This would be open to anybody, state agencies, citizens, industry, whoever was interested in accessing that data. And we would have that as publicly available. And then finally, we would have an education and outreach component to make sure that there was reasonable use of the data, to know what the limitations are, and to provide through University of Minnesota Extension provide training to agencies that would be using this data. Finally, the in-kind support is significant through this project. We would leverage the resources at the University of Minnesota Supercomputing Institute. They are a fabulous resource. Most Big Ten schools do not have these resources. This is a real gem of the university, and we could leverage about almost $2.5 million of that to use on this project. It's a tremendous benefit. So I'm going to end right there, and I'll entertain any questions. I also just want to say that I have some specific examples at the back that might give you some indication of how this data could be used for individual state agencies. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you. Any questions? Any questions? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. excuse me. Professor, I'm curious to know what hand you had in working with Representative Wagenius in crafting the language for this bill.
The language, I believe, from...
She did it. And if there's one... I will take responsibility for that. And if you see that it needs changing between now and the next stop, which is climate and energy, I'd be glad to do that.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
That's it for now.
Any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify?
We do have another someone who signed up to testify, if we could bring them up.
Yes. Welcome.
So my name is Beth Tomlinson, and I am a Minneapolis resident, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of ASHRAE. ASHRAE is a global society that focuses on buildings, building designs, energy efficiency, occupant health and safety, and as well as sustainability in the built environment. Our members develop research and write standards, such as the Building Standards for Energy Efficiency, which are then adopted into the International Building Codes. Through my work on the International Committee for the Global Climate Change Position Document, as well as my work on the National Technical Committee on Climatic Information, I can tell you that our society acknowledges that climates are changing. And we're currently preparing an international research project to develop guidance for design engineers in terms of incorporating projected climatic information. And this is an attempt to mitigate the increasing climate liability for design professionals. Through my representation of ASHRAE and my work as a steering leader in the Minnesota Resiliency Collaborative, I've researched the projected climatic information for various industries and organizations within the state of Minnesota. And I can tell you that the dynamically downscaled climatic data is the most refined. This Minnesota chapter of ASHRAE would like to fully support this bill, not only for the enhanced and improved methodologies that this dynamical downscale climate model provides, but also for its availability, its data storage, and its training. We believe that publicly available projected climatic information is critical in the state of Minnesota for all of our research and adaptation measures. And so I know that the state of Minnesota has been a leader in sustainability and energy efficiency for years, and we believe that it's time to become national leaders in adaptation as well. And that the Minnesota's chapter of ASHRAE is available as a resource, and we're excited for any continued conversations on mitigation and adaptation. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank Representative Wagenius for bringing this forward. I think we didn't go through all the examples from your first testifier, but climate comes up again and again, whether it's this committee or, you know, honestly, every committee at this point. And I think, you know, especially as we're planning forest management, as our local cities are planning what to do with, you know, water treatment and potential flooding. And I also was really interested in the idea of being able to use this data for future planning for Lyme disease as well. So I think there are definitely some health impacts that I want to make sure we mention today. And I do also like the piece where the information will be publicly available. I'm sure, you know, these are just examples of what government could do with this data, but I'm sure that our innovative private businesses will have will be able to make good use of the data too as they're deciding where to invest and you know, what kind of products are going to be needed. So I really like the public access piece of that.
Thank you.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Wiginez, for bringing this forward. I'm just curious, is there any way, you know, with your bill to incorporate some of the testimony that we received from the previous one around microplastic? Is there anything, you know, how could can we even draw a connection between climate change and how that's impacting microplastics in, you know, our waterways or vice versa? I'm just curious to see if that's a potential that could be looked at with this bill too going forward.
Representative Wiginez.
Thank you, Representative Lee. I have not thought about that. I mean, one of the things that we will be able to see with this, and we can certainly have a professor come back and talk to you, is big rain events, washing off, where does the water go? When I have talked to other folks about this bill, I think for MnDOT, you put in a pipe this big or you put in a pipe this big, but what is in the water is what you're asking. And I don't know the answer to that, but I wondered if the professor might have any answers.
If you could just state that into the microphone so we can get that into...
Yeah, I can't comment on the... thank you, Chair. I can't comment on the plastics issue within the water supply. I think your previous testifier definitely could talk about that. I can say that we have been looking a lot at extreme events, extreme precipitation events. Minnesota is undergoing the second of the regions of the United States. Minnesota and the upper Midwest is encountering the second greatest number of extreme precipitation events in the country outside of New England. About a 40% increase in those 2 to 3 inch rainfall events, and then some of these even larger events. So definitely there's a crossover between what's going on with the climate and what's going on with the impacts at the ground, at the land surface, for sure.
Assembly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a final comment, too, and, you know, having looked at the previous testimony and looking at it here where it talks about the environmental exposure, and so, you know, as we proceed forward, I think that that's something that's important for us to look at. How is that impacting our farmland, air, and freshwater and oceans, like it has said here on the handout too. So thank you very much, Representative Williams, for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Williams, I find it interesting that the amount of money for the study is $411,000. I'm wondering what science went into determining $411,000. It's not $411,563, it's $411,000.
Okay. When we get to the next, this committee is not funding this project.
I understand that.
So the committee that would fund this, if we can, would be climate and energy. We will change that figure. That's a marker in there, but that figure is not, do not take that to the bank. We will change it when we are ready to incorporate it into an omnibus bill.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just all excited about that number. Dr. Snyder, or Professor Snyder, excuse me, I'm curious to know, do you have any numbers on how much money is being spent worldwide or in the United States, maybe even closer to home at the University of Minnesota? How much money is being spent currently on climate change and climate change resilience and those types of things?
Dr. Snyder? I can't answer that question. I don't know. I only know from my own research group and vaguely with regards to my colleagues in my department about how much money we receive from the research from federal government or from private agencies and the like. But I can't comment on the country or as a whole.
Representative Fabian. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then at the U, what are you doing at the U in terms of the number of studies going on and the amount of dollars being spent?
Representative Fabian, or Representative Wagenius.
Let's separate issues here because this is not the question of whether climate change is real. This is the question, so we will work on mitigating with other strategies.
This, and Representative Fabian.
And this, Mr. Chair, well, I mentioned that in my comments. I said resilience.
Yeah, we are. This is adaptation, resilience. And so these are the kinds of things. This is the basic information we need to make good decisions, because sometimes we make decisions without good information. And what we're after here is really good information that can help us make really good decisions.
Dr. Snyder. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will repeat the question for Dr. Snyder. So specifically in this area, what's going on at the U?
Well, again, I'd have to add, I mean, there's a lot of people in a lot of departments who are doing work that is either directly or tangentially related to climate change. So it's difficult for me to come up with a dollar amount. In my own research group, I have projects that are either directly or tangentially related to climate change, probably on the order of maybe $1.5 million.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then just one last question, just process-wise for the author. You said that obviously this committee is not going to be funding this, and you want to take it from the RDA. What's going to be the final stop on this bill, do you think? Which committee?
Mine, climate and energy.
Okay. And then would it be part of an omnibus bill or go to the floor?
Oh, we will do all our financing in an omnibus finance bill, just like everybody else does.
Energy and climate, each division, Representative Fabian. Thank different you. Division than mine, than ours.
Okay.
Ours.
I'm just going to be omnibus prime two or no, go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Anyone in the audience? Representative Wagenius renews her motion that House File 1251 be recommended to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommended referral to the Energy and Climate Finance and Policy Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Motion prevails.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair Member.
Turning over the gavel to Representative.
All right, after adjusting my chair a bit lower, the next bill we have up is House File 1928. Chair Hansen, would you like to introduce your bill?
I would move House File 1928 to be laid over to be brought up at a later date.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Hansen, Chair Hansen, why are we laying this over? Why don't we move this bill? There seems to be a deadline coming, and
Madam Chair and Representative Fabian, the deadline coming up is for the policy bills. So this will be going to Representative Lilly's committee, as we did with Outdoor Heritage. We're presenting the bill. Actually, this bill we had to compile from the budgets of each of the agencies. So having it out in the open for a while and for the potential for any possible changes.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen, please present the bill then.
Chair Claflin, House File 1928 is, as I just mentioned, a compilation of the Clean Water Council recommendations. And I have with me the new director of the Clean Water Council, Paul Gardner, to walk through the bill. Mr. Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. My name is Paul Gardner. I'm the administrator for the Clean Water Council. Thanks for the promotion. Appreciate it. We have three speakers
today.
You may
have to adjust the salary, I think.
I've had a lot of calls in the last 2 days asking whether Representative Hansen's bill, House File 1928, is in fact the official set of recommendations from the Clean Water Council, and in fact they are in alignment. That is the first time, from what I understand, that this has happened. So this is a very positive thing. So everybody can relax.
For how long?
Madam Chair, I would like to introduce one of the members of our council, Mr. John Barton, who is the chair of our policy committee and a member of our leadership team, who will get us started. And then I'll jump in with some top-level findings, I think, and then we'll have the agencies describe some of the detail in the bill.
Thank you, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, thank you for allowing us to speak this afternoon on the Clean Water Legacy Clean Water Fund recommendations. As they indicated, my name is John Barton, and I serve on the Clean Water Council. I represent Lakes and Streams nonprofit organizations, which are primarily lake homeowner associations. The Clean Water Council, the slide indicates, was actually established in 2006 by the legislature to advise the governor and the legislature on implementation of the Federal Clean Water Act. And in that regard, the council worked with state agencies and the legislature to develop a watershed approach to the work necessary to implement that Clean Water Act. And that was to basically identify the impaired waters in the state, to develop plans to address the impairments and determine what the sources of the problems were, to implement restoration activities, and ultimately, hopefully, to delist the waters. As part of that was also to protect waters that didn't need improvement but were probably threatened. In 2008, then the Minnesota voters approved the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment to help fund these improvements and accelerate the implementation of the necessary projects. The Legacy Act actually expanded the water resource charge for both the Clean Water Council as well as state agencies to include protecting, enhancing water quality and basically all lakes, streams, and rivers, so beyond the impaired waters list, and also to protect groundwater. And here's a special focus on drinking water concerns, of which there are quite a few in the state of Minnesota. Clean Water Council, per se, is a group of citizens from various and representing various constituency groups. There's 17 voting members on the council, and they recommend to the legislature and the governor on how the Clean Water Fund is to be allocated in order to protect and improve water resources in Minnesota. Members, as I indicated, represent a broad spectrum of stakeholder groups, including farm organizations, business organizations, environmental organizations, local units of government that are involved in water quality management. In addition, there are four members of the legislature on the Clean Water Council, two members from the House, two members from the Senate, in addition, representatives from the Metropolitan Council and the University of Minnesota, as well as state agency groups. And as Paul kind of indicated, historically, the Clean Water Council and the state agencies develop recommendations for allocating the Clean Water Fund in kind of a parallel process. And so there were sometimes differences that arose during the final recommendations. Over the past 2 years, the council worked with the state agencies to prioritize the funding recommendations. So we did a cooperative budgeting or allocation recommendation process. And the council, in our part of our process, we take input from many, many groups that are interested in clean water improvements in the state of Minnesota, farm organizations, environmental organizations, nonprofit organizations, as well as local units of government that are actively involved in water management. So we take all of that input, so we have maybe slightly different priorities than the state agencies sometimes have. So we will resolve those differences over the process of the last 2 years. And ultimately came up with a set of recommendations that both Clean Water Council members as well as the state agencies agreed with. And Mr. Gardner and Mr. Elverum will present those in a few moments. Now, in order to better focus on what and to better prioritize what our funding recommendations are, the Clean Water Council, along with state agencies, developed a couple of goals and objectives that would, again, help focus where the best allocation of the Clean Water Fund would be. And those four goals are that drinking water should be safe for everyone, everywhere in Minnesota, and the objectives would be to protect public water supplies and ensure private well users throughout the state have safe water. Then groundwater should be clean and available to everyone, and that involves improving and protecting groundwater quality, as well as making sure that there's adequate groundwater available for all Minnesotans. And surface waters are swimmable and fishable. And again, protecting preventing the pollution of water bodies, as well as protecting high water quality bodies. And then protecting the hydrologic system, which you just heard about with the climate change issues. And finally, that Minnesotans would value water and take action to protect and sustain it. So those are our four objectives that both state agencies and Clean Water Council agreed on as our primarily overriding objectives. And the actual specific budget recommendations are tied, each of them, to these four goals. And with that, I'll let Mr. Gardner tell you what exactly the details of those recommendations are.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I won't do all the details, but I work among many scientists, but I've worked in politics, sales, and advocacy, so this slide is something that I'm not sure my science friends are exactly comfortable with, because I'm trying to hit you over the head with a blunt instrument here, and that is to show changes since the last biennium in where the recommendations are at. You see a green downward arrow. The MPCA has actually completed its first 10-year cycle of monitoring our waters as required, and therefore they are getting less because they're starting a second 10-year cycle and require less money. So they're getting 15% less for monitoring. Now that's 15% of a fairly large number, so that's $3 million that we're shifting to implementation and getting that money out of St. Paul and giving it mostly to the Health Department and to the Board of Water and Soil Resources for implementation. I don't like the word implementation, but that is the word we are given. The up arrows show significant increases, although these are for smaller dollar amounts than the actual drop in monitoring numbers, but it shows a change in priorities toward more implementation towards private wells, grants to watersheds, particularly those that have completed watershed management plans, giving more technical assistance to local units of government to be able to protect water resources. I suspect you were all visited by your Soil and Water Conservation District supervisors yesterday, perhaps, or sometime this week, and I'm sure they all talked about the importance of state money for technical assistance. I always get questions in the time that I've been in the role about whether Clean Water Fund money is supplanting rather than supplementing existing funds for environmental purposes for clean water. We actually ask all applicants required to supplant, or excuse me, it's required to supplement existing funding, not supplant it. And every applicant for money from the Clean Water Council is required to indicate whether this is going to supplement something that's already being funded or not. There are a few programs where a program existed before and it was receiving some general fund dollars or other state funding, but it was able to be scaled up to affect more change because of the Clean Water Funds. I just wanted to mention to you a couple of things that I've just come across in the last few weeks since starting the work, where it's very clear that were it not for clean water funding, several projects would not have happened, or certainly at the scale that they're happening. I was able to go with our board chair, Frank Jewell, who's a St. Louis County Commissioner from Duluth, and the PCA Commissioner to take a look at the St. Louis River. There are several dozen areas of concern designated by the EPA. On the Great Lakes, there's a Great Lakes Restoration Initiative going on where they're trying to clean up contaminated sites around the Great Lakes, and the St. Louis River for the 20 miles upstream from the Twin Ports is scheduled to be delisted from that area of concern list by 2025. That is because clean water funding and some legacy dollars from Lessard-Sams have been able to leverage federal funding that other states have not been able to leverage because they don't have a local match. So we're ahead of several dozen other contaminated sites around the Great Lakes. This is going to sound weird, but I have specialized in sewage over the years. And so I ask a lot of questions about that, and I've discovered that the MPCA has been able to repair or replace or otherwise connect to a city sewer system over 700 property owners who had septic systems that were failing and were imminent threats to public health. These are the very critical things that you don't want leaking into the environment. The Department of Ag has a loan program where you can get very favorable loan terms to be able to fix your septic system that is posing an imminent threat to public health, and they fixed over 600 of those. I did get some handy-dandy back-of-envelope numbers, and those 700 septic systems that the PCA does are now treating 47.9 million gallons of water a year that was sewage that is not going into the environment anymore. That's a big number. And that is targeted for low-income households that otherwise would not have the wherewithal to spend roughly an average of $18,000 to replace a septic system. Similar to what you heard presented before, we have a program for contaminants of emerging concern. There are thousands of substances which are not tested by the federal government for health risk limits or any sort of health guidance value. Because of clean water funds, the Department of Health is able to test. It's still small, relatively speaking, roughly I think it's 10 contaminants a year, 20 per biennium. So what's a little frightening is that there are thousands more substances to look at. And finally, just as a former Ramsey County Soil and Water Conservation District supervisor, I've seen how clean water funds have done restoration activities where there is a watershed management plan. And we have half a dozen examples of where major recreational lakes have been aided by stream restoration upstream. We have till 2:15, so I'm going to stop there and pass this off to Mr. Elverum from the Department of Health. I do have a pie chart here that just shows the general outlay of expenditures here, obviously showing the heavy reliance on implementation here.
Madam Chair and committee members, Chris Elverum with the Department of Health. And I'm also here representing an interagency team made up of representatives from six state agencies in the Metropolitan Council, all who receive clean water funds. And this team's been in existence since the beginning of the Clean Water Fund, and it really works to make sure that our efforts are coordinated and systematic and are conducted in an efficient manner. And in the interest of time, I'm going to just give you a very quick overview of the funding categories that we use to organize the work at the agencies and also the categories that the council uses to make recommendations. And as Mr. Gardner mentioned, the biggest piece of the puzzle or pie and the piece that has increased the most is in implementation. This is where activities on the ground make a direct impact on our water quality and quantity. And that picture you can see there is an example of a stream bank restoration where the water quality is improved as well as the habitat both in the river and along the stream banks. We're going to focus quickly on non-point source funding. And so since from 2010 to 2017, approximately $361 million was passed to non-state entities. And of that, 81% was focused on implementation. An example of an implementation program that has received funding recently is the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, or CREP. It's a state, federal, and local partnership that focuses conservation efforts, in this case, specifically on areas that are contributing nutrients to our surface waters, as well as areas that protect our most vulnerable groundwater that's used as drinking water. And, of course, it has the added benefit of any conservation measures that improve hydrology and mitigate flooding, as well as providing habitat. Through the first 10 or 9 years of the Clean Water Fund, there have been nearly 1,500 grants, nearly 800 loans, and almost 500 easements that have been funded for non-point restoration and protection activities. And although it's been a significant amount of funding, the requests still are approximately 3 times the available funds. So there's a great need out there. And you know, so it's all the more important that we target where these measures are put in place, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. Another example of a program that has directly addressed surface water and non-point sources is the Minnesota Agricultural Water Quality Certification Program, and now has over 700 farms certified, covering 460,000 acres and 1,400 new conservation practices. One more quick statistic, too. Through all of the programs funded for non-point source implementation, over 6,870 best management and conservation practices have been implemented, resulting in a reduction of over 116,000 pounds of phosphorus and 121,000 tons of sediment that's prevented from going into our surface waters. This is just a quick example of a success story. The Poplar River, which flows into Lake Superior up near Lutzen, was listed. It had an impairment for sediment, and this was due to stormwater, bank erosion, and bluffs that slump. And through a partnership with local citizens who did monitoring and clean water funds, this that sediment issue has been addressed, and this river is in the process of being delisted. In addition to the funds that are used for non-point source implementation, there are funds that go for point source implementation. These are primarily for wastewater and stormwater infrastructure projects. And you can see there are $93 million so far for 85 projects to upgrade municipal wastewater and stormwater infrastructure, and $8.3 million in grants and loans to help unsewered subdivisions deal with failing septic systems. That picture there is the city of Waterville that received a Clean Water Fund grant and upgraded its wastewater treatment facility, and as a result has reduced the phosphorus output from that facility by 10,452 pounds per year. And also, as Mr. Gardner had mentioned, there had an increase in this proposed budget in this bill for groundwater and drinking water implementation. And several different programs have focused on that, including the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Department of Health, who provide funds for well sealing, as well as focusing on conservation and BMP practices in areas that are highly vulnerable to groundwater contamination, and protect our drinking water supplies. Department of Ag working with local governments and farmers to address nitrate, which we know is an issue in certain parts of the state for groundwater and drinking water. And the Pollution Control Agency, again, I think this is something that Mr. Gardner mentioned earlier, that resources are provided so that subsurface sewage treatment systems or septic systems can be addressed, and those can also contribute to groundwater quality issues. All this implementation really, as I mentioned before, needs to be focused, because we don't have unlimited funds. And the way we do that is through first understanding where the issues are and where the most effective practices can be placed on the land. So the monitoring assessment, which again was mentioned, that we have now completed the 10-year cycle in the state. So all 80 major watersheds have been monitored, and that information is being used to more accurately target where those implementation measures are in place. But we need to continue this monitoring, just not at quite the level as we have in the past. We need to understand whether or not our implementation measures are working, and we also need to be able to adjust based on what we find as we continue to monitor. Both surface water and lakes are monitored, and this is just a map of lake monitoring in the state. And as you might guess, different parts of the state have different water quality in our lakes. And just a quick stat, based on water clarity, which is a really good measure of lake health, 34% of lakes in the state are improving, 18% are declining, 32% are stable, and 16% are not sufficient to determine a trend. But this, again, this monitoring helps us understand where we see improvements. It also helps us to measure whether or not the practices we put in place are actually having the desired effect. Not only do we monitor and measure our surface waters, but we also have a variety of programs that address groundwater quantity and quality monitoring. The health department is working to understand the risks to private well owners and the contaminants of emerging concern that was mentioned. Department of Ag has a well network that helps to understand the impact of agriculture on groundwater, as well as their township testing program that really looks at nitrate and pesticides in private wells. The Pollution Control Agency monitors wells for those emerging contaminants, a variety of things like personal care products and pharmaceuticals. And the DNR is responsible for monitoring our water levels in the state to really ensure that we're using our groundwater sustainably. This information from the monitoring and assessment is rolled into what's known as the Watershed Restoration and Protection Strategies, or the Groundwater Restoration and Protection Strategies. Maybe you've heard of RAPS. These Watershed Restoration and Protection Strategies take the information from the monitoring and assessment and help to explain and to demonstrate where the implementation will have the most effect. And these RAPs are then used by the local entities to incorporate into the local watershed comprehensive plan. Similarly, more recently, we have developed these groundwater restoration and protection strategies. And this was an acknowledgement that although groundwater doesn't really lend itself necessarily to do the science on the watershed scale, the management is being done on the watershed scale. And so we are packaging groundwater information and delivering it to the local governments for planning and implementation on that watershed scale. And the increase in funding that's proposed for this next biennium would also provide some small grants so that those local governments, and primarily it's SWCDs and counties and watershed districts, to actually promote and get these practices to protect our groundwater and drinking water supplies implemented. The Comprehensive Local Watershed Management Plan takes this information from our monitoring and assessment and from our RAPs and GRAPs and develops an actionable plan. You may have heard of it called the One Watershed, One Plan. And over the last 10 years, we've shifted focus from a political boundary, a county boundary, to a watershed boundary for our planning and implementation. It just makes more sense. And these plans are really focused on prioritizing those areas based on what we understand from the science, targeting the practices that will have the most effect, and then being able to measure the impact of the implementation on the water resources. We still have a need to continue to do some basic research and some tool development. These are things like the county geologic atlases, which provide a very basic information on our water and our geology in the state, water conservation and reuse, BMP development, and specifically one initiative that's been funded by the Clean Water Fund is this Forever Green initiative. This is done through the University of Minnesota in cooperation with the Department of Agriculture. And what we know is that if you keep vegetation on the land, it helps to reduce runoff, it helps to reduce sediment and nutrients from leaving the land and impacting our water resources. But those cover crops and the perennial crops don't necessarily make the same kind of money that a row crop agriculture. So this program is really looking at how can we bind the markets and make it economically at least neutral so that agriculture producers can implement these practices.
And thank you. In the interest of time, so we just have a few minutes, I was just going to wrap up. I did want to mention that this is the first time I think we've, or mention it again, that the governor's budget and the Clean Water Council recommendations line up. I know that the legislature decides what the budget is going to be and decides the law. We only recommend, but we hope that you would recognize the hard work of our members who helped vet these programs and consider, anyway, I would be remiss if I didn't ask if you would adopt it without any changes, but obviously I think there are people who have a particular interest in something else. So thank you.
Thank you. We do have questions. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. Just real quickly, how many other names do you have on your list?
One other.
Okay, very good.
So far.
So far. And so then in the interest of that, just a preliminary, Chair Hansen, if this bill is going to stay here in this committee and we don't get to all the questions, we ask that these folks come back again for the other hearing.
And Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know if there's anybody in the audience who made a trip to maybe,
sure.
Is there anyone in the audience who made a trip to testify who's here? I just want to make sure we give anybody who may have traveled. So.
Okay.
See, no one will take your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Anybody here from Public Facilities Authority? And the reason I'm asking is on page 5, line 5.29 and 5.30, we're talking about $125,000 for small community wastewater treatment grants. I don't know what we know about wastewater treatment plants. I know a fair amount about them just from what I've heard, and I'm not sure how far $125,000 is going to go. So is that just a placeholder, and now we're going to listen to what Mr. Gardner said before about listening to the you're here to advise the legislature? So,
well, Madam Chair and committee members, Jeff Friedman was here, and he told me he had to step out at 2 o'clock, so perhaps if this comes back to the committee, that would be a good time. I don't know if anyone else does that.
Sure. I can come back to that. Then on page 9 of the bill, at the bottom, 9.27 in that paragraph, it talks about mercury assessment and so forth. I'm curious to know if the DNR is going to be coordinating their activities with MPCA, because I know MPCA has gotten mercury studies as well.
Mr. Alvarum?
Sorry, Madam Chair, Jason Meckel from DNR can answer.
Thank you, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, committee members, Jason Meckel, Department of Natural Resources. This is a cooperative effort between the PCA, the Department of Health, and the DNR. All that we do with this is to pay for the chemical analysis. We pull the fish through lake surveys, and then this money goes to supplement the number of fish that we're able to analyze for, and it helps inform the fish consumption advisories.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then I heard the SWCD's issue came up, and I'm curious to know how much money specifically may be available to SWCDs. We had a conversation in our committee yesterday about that, and how are those dollars going to get out, and maybe Bowser needs to help out a little bit too. I'm not sure.
Mr. Alvarum.
And Madam Chair and committee, Doug Thomas from the Board of Water and Soil Resources is here, so we'll defer to him.
Mr. Chair, Doug Thomas, Board of Water and Soil Resources, Representative Fabian. The only direct appropriation in the Bowser portion of the budget is the $2.5 million per year that is for buffer implementation, and approximately $2 million of that is made available in grants to SWCDs based on their buffer workload that we look at and assess on an annual basis. Other access to funds is through the watershed-based funding, which goes out to watersheds. They're obviously much of the implementation scheme, as well as some of the competitive grant programs. And then there's a small portion of funds that go out to support engineering and engineering technical assistance through the accelerated implementation program here. And that ranges in about a couple million dollars that goes to groups of SWCDs that have hired engineers and engineering technicians to support their project work.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, on page 11, the first two parts there, A and B, when I do a quick count, there's $50 million roughly there, if I did my math right. And it says for local government units, would the SWCDs be able to apply for those grants as well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, yes. The item A or on 11.7 is funding now that is being used to support the watershed implementation plans that have been developed. So we got basically in the state, we've got 87 soil and water conservation districts, 87 counties, and 46 watershed districts. Those are the primary local governments that we work with. They're all part of, you know, those implementation plans at a watershed level, and then under the projects and practices, that on 11.23, that's where individual local governments or groups of governments can compete on a competitive basis for those funds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And real quickly, just a quick update on CREP. I mean, we've spent millions of dollars trying to get the government, the federal government match. How much do we have enrolled in that now, or is that something, that's something you can send me later?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, right now our current estimate for what the state's commitment would be to fully leverage the federal funds available for the CREP program, it's about $175 million. To date, we have about $141 million of state money obligated, and that's been in the form of clean water funds, Lessard Outdoor Heritage, and bonding. And so that the balance there is what will get us to the rest of the way, combination of $20 million in this recommendation for CREP, along with we'll be seeking and continuing to work with Lessard Outdoor Heritage and potential bonding to get to that full $175 million.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm more interested now in the number of acres that we actually have enrolled in the CREP program, but maybe later. And then on page 16 at the top, Q, the board may shift grant or cost share funds in this section and may adjust. Is that boilerplate language?
Mr.
Or is it something new?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that language has existed since the beginning of Clean Water Fund appropriations. Gives the board some flexibility as we look at a balance that remains or funds that might get returned from a grant that wasn't fully executed. Allows our board to then allocate those to appropriations in here and get that money back out the door for projects.
Thank you.
Representative Heisman passes. Representative Wiginius.
Just real quick for the next meeting. On page 3, you say that you need to monitor and measure to accurately target. And I would agree that that's the right thing to do. But then I go back on page 2, and you say you have a 33% increase in surface and drinking water protection grants, but you have never measured surface water for drinking water contaminants. So my first question will be, how do you target if you've never measured? And the second question is, 33% is what? Out of what? I mean, is it $100 or $1,000? So when you're doing percentages, we need to know the base. We need to know context for numbers, not just percentages.
Mr. Alvaro?
Yep, Madam Chair and Representative McGinnis, this is for next time, I understand, so we'll do our homework and get back to you.
Thank you. And Representative Purcell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be quick this part for next time, too. looking at the same part of the bill here that Representative Fabian referred to on page 9 and assessing mercury, and including monitoring. Are you doing wet and dry deposition monitoring? Is anybody doing that?
Mr. Alvarez?
Again, homework for us, Madam Chair, I hope. I don't know offhand.
And I would also add to that that not just for mercury, but for dioxin, otherwise known as Agent Orange, we've got that coming at us atmospherically, at least in our northern lakes.
Okay. Chair Hansen.
Thank you. We'll continue the discussion. I would move to lay this over.
We do not need to vote on that, and we need to get to our caucus meetings. If there's no questions from the audience right now, seeing none, we will adjourn.